batter at his very best. We saw in Shanghai those reflexes that are incredible, like a mongoose on amphetamine.
Murray wins it all. He's champion of the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals.
Has done it. Joe Konta. It is confirmed. Joe Konta with the biggest title of her career at the Miami Open and now also at a new career high.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Shot flew up.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of Strawberries and Cream, your URN tennis podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the French Open, which is just finished over in Paris. So we're going to start with the big news from the men's tournament, which is that Rafa Nadal has won his record 11th Roland Garros title, looking dominant throughout the tournament, beating Dominic Thiem in straight sets in the final. Guys, you know, did anybody even look close to getting to him this tournament?
I mean, it was literally never in doubt, was it? I mean, I think we spoke about it on the last Strawberries and Cream podcast. We spoke about it on the Tuesday show a couple of times. And however much you wanted to sort of raise a discussion about it, throw a few other names into the mix, the likes of Zverev, Thiem, who did end up making it to the final, there was absolutely no question. I think even though he's getting older and he's already won 10 already, I'd arguably say that this he was probably the favourite. He was probably more of a favourite leading into this one than he ever has been in the past, and that really is saying something.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Last time in the last podcast, we were discussing different names, and we all concluded at the end that there was no other chance that anyone else could potentially compete against Nadal. And Nadal completely showed that his dominance, his force, his power. I mean, winning 37 sets in a row, it's a shame he didn't eclipse the 41, which is a record. But still, it's an amazing achievement from Nadal, and he's going to continue, I think, being this dominant over the clay court.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, this was his 17th Grand Slam title. He is closing in on Roger Federer. Federer has won 20 Grand Slam titles. Nadal only three behind, you know. Obviously, these two men have won the last six Grand Slams between them. You know,
it's crazy, isn't it?
It is crazy, considering their age and their resurgence. Can Nadal catch Federer, do you think?
I think so, because I think a lot of it is dependent on who retires first, because I think Nadal's a couple of years younger, but I mean,
yeah,
Federer's shown
Nadal's 32 and Federer's 35.
At the same time, I think he's slightly more injury prone than Federer. I mean, he's just got a body of steel, doesn't he? I mean, he obviously didn't enter the French Open, and I think that was a great decision. This is another thing I think we touched upon on the last podcast, but I think Federer made the perfect decision not entering the French Open, because I couldn't see him beating Nadal, and he's going to be fresh, he's going to be ready for Wimbledon, and I think he has to go into that tournament as favourite. But then again, yeah, I mean, you can see Nadal win in the next three or four French Opens if he carries on. I mean, if he carries on till he's 40, he could win another 7 or 8, to be honest with you. I can't remember, I don't know how old he is exactly. He's early 30s, I think, now, isn't he? Or?
Yeah, so Nadal's 32 and Federer is 35. So I guess that was sort of leading on to my next question, which is really, you know, how long do you see his dominance going on for? Could we be looking at a 15-time Roland Garros champion, do you think?
I mean, like, going back to whether Nadal could eclipse Federer, I don't think he will eclipse him as such, but he'll get incredibly close, because I feel like Nadal's dominance over the clay court is far superior than Federer's dominance over the grass court, because that's a much closer event than the clay court, so I think he will catch him up. But yeah, going back to your question, I think he could hit 15 as long as he stays. There is rumors that he may not be playing in Wimbledon, and he may choose not to do so. He may choose not to participate. But if he does choose to do that, then he'll definitely be able to eclipse 15 titles.
Yeah, I think the thing you have to look at as well is you look at some of the players that Nadal played en route to winning that 11th Roland Garros title, and I'd say probably the two informed players in the world at the minute, in Dominic Thiem, who I think beat him a few weeks prior.
He's the only player to beat Nadal on clay this season. I think it was at the Madrid Masters he won.
And I mean, I watched Thiem in that semi-final, and he looked imperious, the way he was striking the ball. Clay is obviously his main surface, and Del Potro, who we've spoken about a lot, who's made a resurgence this year, which I think everybody is pleased about, but Nadal completely outclassed him. And the thing is, he'll never be, he hasn't got the biggest forehand on tour, he hasn't got the biggest serve on tour, but watching him on clay is just ridiculous. That banana shot which he pulls out time and time again is the most aesthetically pleasing tennis I think you can see. And I honestly think that, yeah, if he plays his cards right, if he thinks about which tournaments to enter, perhaps if he does what Federer's doing and maybe doesn't play all of the Grand Slams, then you can easily see him carrying on this for another 3 or 4 years, because at the minute, the likes of TM, who you'd say is the only person who can really challenge him at the minute, can't do so.
I mean, his serve points wins was far superior than his previous years. I mean, he won 76% of his first serves and 56% of his second serves, and that is just far superior than any of the other competitors.
His second serve percentage, I think, is higher than anyone in the world, I think I read.
And yeah,
over the last 5 years, he's progressively got it up more and more, because that used to be one of his weaknesses, and I think that just goes to show that even the best players have stuff that they can work on. And
I mean, he won 12% of his points just based on his forehand alone in that tournament. 12%.
Which is incredible when you think about that, and I think that just shows that, I think, he probably does have the best forehand of all time. I don't think many people would dispute that. Federer's got a great one too, but I think Nadal is just so lethal, especially on the clay with that vicious topspin. He is just too difficult to play. And that is, I think, one of the reasons why he's been so successful. His topspin style suits the clay court so much compared to the other players, and it's so difficult to look against. And it benefits him much more when it's hot. Part of the reason he lost the first set of his match against the Argentinian Diego Schwartzman was because of the fact that it was a bit overcast and rainy, so that meant that his balls were flatter. Yeah. Well, I saw a stat that meant his balls, when it was the next day when they resumed the match and it was sunny, his balls were then bouncing, I think, 5 or 6 inches higher.
It's always frustrating when you see matches like that when sort of the underdog's doing well and then there's a rain delay and they end up coming back out the next morning and suddenly things change. I mean, I remember at Wimbledon a couple of years ago where I think Kevin Anderson was 2 sets up against the most informed Novak Djokovic I've ever seen, who was pretty much unbeatable at that stage. There was a rain delay, they went off, and Djokovic came back out the next morning and won 3 straight sets. And I think that was the same case with that Nadal match there. But an interesting interview that I read the other day was with Robin Soderling, who is, I think, one of 2 people to beat Nadal at Roland Garros.
The other one being Djokovic.
Ever. Yeah, the other one being Djokovic, obviously, who I think smashed him when he was in the form that I was just alluding to there. But Soderling said that during that match, he literally had to take on every forehand, because if he didn't, Nadal would make him pay. Like, anybody who tries to go on the back foot against him, anyone who tries to play defensively, will lose. Like, he is impossible to beat unless you go on the offensive against him. You have to go all out, go for every one of your shots, and it's probably 95% of the time not going to work, but everything went right for Robin Soderling on that day, and he admits that he was very, very lucky to win that match.
Yeah, well, of course, Robin Soderling losing to Roger Federer in that final in 2010, leading the way for Federer to win his only French Open title. But I think we've talked about Nadal for long enough and the French Open, so I think we should probably examine some of his challenges. Obviously, Alexander Zverev was billed as one of the big challenges before the tournament, but ultimately lost to Dominic Thiem in the quarterfinals, largely due to injury issues. Do you think if he'd been fully fit, he would have beaten Thiem and perhaps given Nadal a better run for his money in the final than Thiem did?
It's a very interesting one. I think that was the match which a lot of people were looking forward to, because they are 2 of the upcoming players in the world, 2 of the form players in the world as well. Actually, I think Zverev has a tournament win quite recently, and TM, as we said, beat Nadal just a couple of weeks ago. So it was a shame that Zverev was suffering with injury. I think personally, on the balance, even if he had been fully fit, I would have gone with TM. The fact that he's made the Roland Garros semi-finals each of the past 2 years, clay is obviously his favoured surface, and obviously that result against Nadal a few weeks ago. So I think, even though both are great players, and I can definitely see Zverev going far in major tournaments and the French Open next year as well, I think TM still probably would have won, in my opinion, and was a deserved finalist.
Yeah, I completely agree. But it was also nice to see more of Zverev's personality during the interviews. I mean, he was joking around a lot more. And that's something I haven't really seen from him. So to bring out that, I always think personality as well is really important in actually supporting a player. And to
Nick
see
Kyrgios
that...
Nick being a prime example.
Well, it's interesting, wasn't it? I don't know if you guys saw, there was a tennis reporter from Yorkshire in one of his press conferences.
Really,
and he just said, you know what, I can't understand a word you're saying, which I found hilarious. But I suppose, to be fair, for somebody who, obviously, to be fair, he speaks quite good English, but obviously not a native English speaker, to hear Yorkshire accents, it must be quite confusing.
No, I mean, we have to give them credit for being able to understand English in general. I mean, Andy Murray's not going to understand any of these German or
although
Spanish
I think he might. I think Andy Murray might know some Spanish because he was in the academy in Spain from the age of 15. So I think feel like he might know a bit of Spanish. But don't quote me on that if you're listening, Andy.
I think you're probably right because he grew up there, didn't he?
But yeah, so that might influence that. But anyway, so Zverev, perhaps one for the future. I mean, we talked a bit earlier about how Nadal might win more Roland Garros's, but I think Zverev's clay game means he is somebody who's definitely got a chance of potentially winning one in the next couple of years.
Oh, definitely. I think, for me, after the whole, you'd say the big four at the minute retire, so Murray, Djokovic, Nadal and Federer, because eventually they will have to. I mean, it could be a decade or so, but one day they will eventually have to retire. And after that, I think four names stand out for me as taken over from them, and they are TM, Zverev, Kyle Edmund, because I genuinely think he's got all the attributes to be
a top-class player.
We've discussed that before, and the final one is Nick Kyrgios, because I think he's one of the most naturally gifted tennis players I've ever seen, and it's just whether or not he gets his attitude straight. I think at the start of this year it looked like things were going in the right direction for him. He seemingly got the Australian crowd on his side, won quite a few games. I don't think he got a tournament win, but I think he got to quite a few semi-finals and finals. But it seemed in recent months he sort of slipped back into old habits. I've seen a couple of aggressive rants at linesmen and reporters and stuff, and it's just a real shame to see, because he is a great talent, and I think he's great for the game of tennis, and I think he's someone who could put tennis on the map just because of the personality sort of thing that Rahul was just speaking about.
You need those big characters. Like in snooker, you had Ronnie O'Sullivan. Although he had his problems with alcohol and stuff, he managed to pull things back. So maybe it's just something about getting a psychologist or someone to mentally help him prepare for games. It may just be a mental thing that he's just not ready in that right mindset, because you see that so many times with football, with talent like Ravel Morrison.
Yeah.
Apparently he was the best Man United youngster there ever was.
I love that you made that reference, Rahul. I've spoken about Ravel Morrison countless times.
What a class
he's
player
he's
could have been.
He's in Mexico class now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's playing in Mexico, unfortunately. And yeah, he was someone who...
He was better than...
the mental side of things,
yeah. Pogba is better than Lingard.
Alex Ferguson said he's the best player.
He gave him
the best
so
youngster
many chances.
He's ever seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, he had his chances. The interesting thing about Kyrgios, though, is it could obviously be a mental thing, but he's come out previously, I think it was a couple of years ago now, and said that he doesn't enjoy playing tennis.
Yeah.
And that he basically does it for the paycheck because he's good at it.
Which is interesting because Andre Agassi, obviously legendary American tennis player who won 8 Grand Slams, world number one many times, he also said that he hated tennis and was forced to play it, but obviously sort of stuck with it a bit more to the extent and one of the best tennis players of all time. I think when you're looking at the best returns in history, I think the three I'd throw up would be Agassi, Djokovic and Murray as probably the three best returners.
I'd completely agree.
So yeah, it's interesting looking at a mindset of a tennis player really and how that could influence them.
I mean, but it is quite a lonely game at times, I think. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's quite similar to boxing in some ways, Murray's always said, in the sense that you've got your team outside the ring, but once you get in there, you know, ultimately it's up to you to deliver the punches and win the points. It comes down to you. Obviously, it's maybe slightly different in doubles, but I think that is one of the things that makes tennis such an interesting game in that aspect. But we've talked about some up-and-coming talents. We're going to move back to some of the older generation and look at Novak Djokovic. He was looking reasonably strong in the tournament until he was unseated by the unseated Italian Marco Cecchinato in the quarterfinals.
To pronounce that name.
I think I messed it up the first time. So obviously Cecchinato never got... I don't think he ever won a Grand Slam match before, let alone got to the semi-finals, and obviously eventually losing in straight sets to TM. But, you know, the fact that Djokovic lost something like this, does this show that he's still searching for that best form?
I think, unfortunately, it does. I mean, Djokovic is another one who we've spoken about at length on each of these podcasts, and he's just seemingly lost that ability to grind out victories, which he used to have. I think you look back at the form that I was alluding to earlier in the podcast, that 2015 form, I think, and I think either the season before that or that same season, he broke the record for consecutive victories on the World Tour. which was something like 30-something. I mean, he beat Nadal in straight sets at Roland Garros, which was only his second loss there of all time. I mean, we've just touched on it. Nadal won 11 French Open titles and Djokovic beat him in straight sets. He was the best player in the world. At one point, people were discussing whether he could beat Federer's record because it was seemingly going that way. I think he won 3 of the 4 Grand Slams and lost the other final to Stanislas Wawrinka, I seem to remember. I think, was that the 2015 season? Or?
Yeah, it's 20,
I think so. I think he beat Federer.
Or maybe 2016, but
He beat Federer at Wimbledon that same year as well. And I mean, we've all spoken as well about how imperious Federer's been at Wimbledon. And it's just a real shame to see because I think that's been the same with Andy Murray as well. Andy Murray, obviously a world-class talent, but just hasn't been able to win those big games, those big points when it really mattered. And I don't know about Djokovic. I don't think things are right in the head with him at the minute. I mean, he's just switched his coaching team again. I mean, it seems like things were going really well with him under Boris Becker, but I can't remember who he switched back to now. But I know he's got rid of him and he's trying everything, it seems. But the one thing I'm not sure about is whether it's still a mental thing or whether he's not fully fit. I don't know what you two think about it, but having watched him, it's quite hard to pinpoint because he's playing in the same way but just not grinding out these results.
I think with Wimbledon especially, if he gets to the second week having had a really good first week, got that momentum. I think it's just a matter of momentum. I don't think it's too much. I mean, he's had a coaching shock move where he's sacked, well, he's three coaches have permanently left. I mean, I just don't think it's a mental, I just think it's something to do with momentum. I think he needs to get a few games under his belt, really get into his stride, and then he could potentially hit top form. But we just never know. He seems to peak and then he seems to drop again. Then seems to peak, seems to drop again. He doesn't have that consistency. And I think if he gets to the second week of Wimbledon, then he could potentially be a real favourite.
Yeah, well, obviously our next episode of Stories and Cream will be a Wimbledon preview. So stay tuned for that. That should be coming out about a week after this episode airs. So if we now look towards the British hopes, mentioning, of course, the British Slam. Obviously, Kyle Edmund, with Andy Murray still injured, was the main hope at Roland Garros. Went out in the third round to Fabio Fognini in a 5-set thriller. Ollie and I watched the match together in the studios here. You know, it was a great match, but ultimately, I think Edmund's lack of big match experience sort of told in the end. And Fognini's obviously been around the tour a while, was able to close it out. Obviously, Kyle Edmund played very well, but do you think I felt like he should have won that match, really.
Yeah, I think the position he was in, he definitely should have won that match. I mean, as you said, we watched it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Fognini is a fantastic clay court player. I think he's one of a handful of people that's beaten Nadal on clay before, admittedly not at Roland Garros, but yeah, that's obviously his preferred surface. But it's like you said, you look at the points where Edmund lost that match, and I think it was the end of that fourth set. It was 4-4, I think it was. Then Fognini won his service game, and Edmund just had to carry on in the same vein he was going. He was serving quite well, but the pressure got to him. He kind of had that thought in his head, you could tell, where, God, if I lose this game, then I've lost the set. And he crumbled, and it was a similar story in the fifth as well. I think it was pretty much on serve for the most part of the set, and then near the end, Edmund crumbled. And let's just hope he doesn't go down the same route as Andy Murray, because he, as I've already touched upon, had similar problems. So yeah, I don't know what it is. That, I mean, the mental side of tennis, really, you can't stress it enough. You can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have the mental strength to see out these big points, I mean, you only have to look at the British women as well. The likes of Heather Watson have had the same problem. I mean, that Wimbledon game against Serena Williams a couple of years ago, where I think she had match point, but just couldn't close it out. It really is a struggle for even the best of tennis players. And let's just hope, if Kyle Edmund is going to make it to the top of men's tennis, as we've touted him to, he's going to have to work on that mental side of things.
I mean, you could tell by his face at the end, he was so disappointed, as almost it was a missed opportunity of him progressing. But things are still positive. I mean, he's got a great serve, he's very aggressive on the baseline, so he's got all the attributes to be a top tennis player. And I mean, he's beaten Djokovic, he's had a great clay court season, if you put it in perspective, minus that one game. So, I mean, things are looking up for him.
Yeah, just on final note, obviously, clay, he's had some success in there before. And, you know, do you think this is potentially his best chance for a Grand Slam in the future?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you, because as Rahul's touched upon, he's got every necessary component for being a successful or top men's tennis player. I mean, I'd say his biggest weapon, maybe his forehand or his serve. I mean, those sorts of credentials are suited to any surface. I mean, you look at Wimbledon, where a lot of the big serving players tend to go quite far. I mean, the likes of Milos Raonic always tend to do well at the likes of Wimbledon, where serving aces is quite a big part of that tournament compared to the likes of French Open, where it's more about the ground strokes and stuff. But it's an interesting one, because I'd say hardcore is probably his best. I mean, we saw him get to the semi-final at the Australian Open, and I think that sort of surface probably suits his type of playing the most. But I honestly think that he could succeed on all surfaces, if I'm completely honest with you. How many times did I say honest in that sentence, G?
Honestly, I don't know. No. But anyway, we're going to move on to the women's side of the draw, which is obviously an interesting tournament in itself. It brought a first Grand Slam title for Simona Halep, the world number one. May, congratulations to her. I don't think anybody in the world tends to begrudge her a title. Seems like a real, true competitor and a very nice person, so may, congratulations to her. Obviously, she was able to turn around the final very well. She was a set and a breakdown to Sloane Stephens, and considering she'd lost three previous finals, including the Roland Garros, three previous Grand Slam finals, that is, including Roland Garros last year, when she was set up, you know, she said about how she did think she was not going to win at one point. Was this a real achievement for her to be able to come from one set and the breakdown?
Definitely. And I'm pleased for her, if I'm honest with you. I mean, she's still in world number one, is she? Or is she world number... I think she's world number one.
She is indeed, but world number one.
It was probably quite tough being the world number one, having not won a Grand Slam. I mean, a lot of people would question you in that sense. And as you said, she's lost her three Grand Slam finals in the past. But I think she deserved it, and she did brilliantly to turn around the game. It's an interesting one, because we were saying before how the Women's French Open tended to throw up a few surprises. I mean, we obviously had shock semi-finalists last year. But this year, I think all of us predicted Simona Halep to go all the way. I know you definitely did, Matt. So, it's interesting that for once, both the male and the female who we predicted to win have won it fairly comfortably in the end.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly a fair reflection of that. Obviously, you know, Simona Halep, first Grand Slam title. Is there more to come for her, do you think? Do you think she's a good enough player to win more titles in the future? You know, world number one, you'd imagine that there's more to come. I think you'd have to say she's potentially the best female clay court tennis player.
I mean, she's got past... It was like Wozniacki. She finally won her first tournament, and that pressure and that burden just lifted upon her. So this could be a real, like, opening of the waters, essentially, where now she's that burden has been lifted, and now she's able to really find her form and really show what she's made of. And that mental barrier is something which is really important to get over. And now having done that, there's potential for a number of tournaments if she keeps, especially with the dominance over clay.
Yeah, well, I think if we return to somebody who's been world number one for a long time and had a bit of a resurgence in Paris, was Serena Williams. Obviously, she had to withdraw from her quarterfinal with Maria Sharapova, her old rival, due to injury. Was it refreshing to see Serena Williams getting back to the top of women's tennis?
No.
Ooh, controversial opinion.
I don't think that women's tennis is going to benefit from Serena Williams anymore. I mean, obviously, she's an absolutely huge name, and she succeeded in putting women's tennis on the map. She's done a lot for the gender pay gap in tennis as well. I think she was one of the big names which came out in support, and a lot of people listened to her, and rightly so. She's one of the best athletes in the world. She should obviously be paid the same as some of these male tennis players. But I think she's won over 20 Grand Slams now. I think, has she equaled Steffi Graf's record as...
I think she might be getting on towards surpassing it. She's definitely gone past a few people. I think she's gone past the likes of Billie Jean King. So yeah, she's completely out there.
I mean, I hope that she does break the record, which I'm sure she will do, but I don't really want to see her around for much longer, because it was refreshing to see the likes of Halep finally win a Grand Slam. I like seeing these smaller names potentially going far in major tournaments and causing an upset. And for a while in women's tennis, we didn't see that, because Serena Williams was so imperious. I mean, you didn't even have to watch women's tennis and you could take a guess or hazard a guess as to who was going to be in the final, and it was going to be Serena Williams. So she's done a lot for the women's game. She's probably the greatest women's tennis player of all time, but I think it's time to let the younger generation start coming through now.
I mean, there was an interview done by the, I think it was the Grand Slam winning coach, David Taylor, I think, and he was doing a preview of the Australian Open, and he said any of the top, this is minus Serena Williams, but he said any of the top 20 players, women players, could potentially win the tournament. But with Serena Williams, it's only going to be her likely. So the fact that when she's not in the draw, any of the top 20 players can participate and win, evidence is that there's so much more competition when she's not playing. So I mean, for the sport, it's great in terms of competition, but whether you can, like, it's like removing Man United or Man City from the Premier League.
The Bundesliga is a league that no one cares about because Bayern Munich pretty much win every year. I mean, Liga is probably a better example. Yeah. PSG are going to win it 9 times out of 10 every single time. And that's what it was like with women's tennis. Serena Williams was going to win 9 out of every 10 tournaments. And it just, after a while, it doesn't become enjoyable anymore. I mean, for a period when Djokovic had his amazing form, he was winning everything as well. And I think men's tennis became quite stale. And competition is one of the biggest aspects of sport. I mean, you compare it to golf with their four major tournaments, and you get a different winner in pretty much every tournament every single year. I mean, the odd golfer has won 3 or 4. The likes of Tiger Woods have won over 10. But for the most part, you see a different winner every single time, and it's very refreshing to see. We don't get that in tennis as much. You get it more so with the female game compared to the men's. And without Serena Williams, I think the women's tennis game could really benefit.
Yeah, well, I think just to round up the women's side, Roland Garros, British aspect, Johanna Konta, not a great clay court player, and she actually hit back at the press after losing in the first round, saying they gave her some unfair criticism at times, you know. Do you think she was justified in saying that?
I think so. I think that our media put too much pressure on our sports people in general. I mean, you only have to look on with the World Cup starting today as it happens. You only have to look at what the media have done to previous England teams, and I think that's affected them. I mean, sportsmen do get affected by these things. They try not to show it, but if you're getting constant criticism, it's quite hard to avoid it. I mean, you're going to see papers out there, you're going to see stuff on the internet, you're going to hear stuff on the radio about you, and it's quite hard not to take it to heart. And I mean, the likes of Johanna Konta, she's been one of the best British female tennis players we've seen in years. I mean, nobody, I think, would have thought a couple of years ago that we were going to see a British female tennis player in the semi-finals of a Grand Slam. And I mean, look at her, she's still the best talent that we've got. And I think, yeah, we need to stop being so harsh on her. As you said, Matt, clay really isn't her surface, and there's nothing wrong with that. And not every tennis player can be fantastic on every surface. And it's going to be interesting to see how she does at Wimbledon. Fingers crossed she can bounce back from that and prove these critics wrong. But yeah, I think we need to stop being quite so harsh on a lot of these sportsmen in general.
I feel like there is a change, though, with the media. I mean, compared to the last few years, they haven't been putting as much pressure. I mean, you can see this with the England team now. There's not as much pressure compared to, I don't know, in South Africa or in the previous World Cup. So I think there is a changing in guard, knowing that the media is playing such a crucial role with these players. So, I mean, hopefully in the next 2 years, it'll even further diminish. But yeah, I mean, it's completely unfair, especially as she's only 27 years old. She hasn't really experienced the hardships such as other players who have gone through that mental resilience to push through.
I just think that we should idolise our sportsmen a bit more. I mean, you look at like the Swiss press compared to Roger Federer. Obviously, he is the greatest tennis player of all time, in my opinion, but if he lost the match a few years ago when Federer was having a dip in form, people were suggesting whether he was going to retire, the media weren't getting on his back. They were calling for him to come back. They absolutely worshipped him. We don't do that with any of our sportsmen. I mean, Andy Murray got a couple of headlines after he won Wimbledon and it was great, but for the most part, when you see headlines about Andy Murray, it's, oh, Andy Murray's still injured, or, oh, is Andy Murray ever going to come back, or will Andy Murray ever be as good as these other tennis players? And it's not nice. It's a really negative view, and I really do think that has a strong impact on how our sports people perform.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. I think that sums up our round of the men's and women's draw. But just before we finish off this roundup, I think it's time we look at the French Open as a whole. In terms of organisation, there's no Hawkeye, which seems bizarre to me.
Really
bizarre. It's the only Grand Slam to not have a roof. Is the French Open lagging behind the other three Grand Slams in terms of quality of organisation?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. Is the reason why they haven't introduced Hawkeye because it's tradition? I know they claim that they technically don't need it because you can see whether the ball's hit the line or not. But I just think if you've got the technology, why not use it? I mean, it would just stop any discrepancies, any scepticism that players might have that a decision was made wrongly. You could just refer to the technology and get on with it. I mean, I think they are lagging behind. I think what we touched upon as well when we watched that Kyle Edmund versus Fanini game is the actual size of the crowd. I mean, at Wimbledon, a game on centre court, even a game on court one, will sell out from the first day of Wimbledon right up until the final.
I think all the outside courts are as well.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone wants a ticket. And I mean, you look at the French Open, it was perfect weather. You were seeing two fantastic players on show. Yeah, I would be surprised if that crowd was half full.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And it's just a shame when you have that quality of tennis recently. And we did put out a poll on our Instagram story. Do you go and check us out on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook, Strawberries and Cream. And it was a 50-50 split as to whether or not the French Open was a sort of quality Grand Slam, which I found very interesting and might arguably detract from the success of people like Nadal at Roland Garros. But I think that summarises our roundup of Roland Garros. Do tune into our next episode, which will be coming soon, a Wimbledon preview. But for now, I've been your host, Matt Webb, joined here by Ollie Roberts and Rahul. And that concludes our roundup.
This is URN Sport.